Pododio, duh, it's crazy words, crazy tune. It's music and popular culture of the early 20th century. Coming to you through the airwaves of Community Radio WRFI in the Finger Lakes of New York State. My name is Roger Kimmel Smith, and this is a special broadcast. It's the long-anticipated second installment from my interviews with Ian Nagoski, whose Canary Records label has produced more than 150 albums of reissued world music and historic sound from the 19-aughts through the 1970s, all available for listening for free on the app known as Bandcamp. The Canary catalog opens up a broad sonic landscape from every part of the world, with special focus on the cultures of the former Ottoman Empire and the people who emigrated from that part of the world to this part, or what he calls the Ottoman American diaspora. Ian does the transfers and remastering himself, mostly from 78 RPM discs, and his deep research into the lives of these musicians is revealed in the liner notes he pens. Ian is also an extremely talented storyteller. The first episode of our talk from mid-2024 can be heard on my own website, smithmeaword.com. And I am super excited to have him back on WRFI's airwaves.
So Ian, welcome back to Crazy Words, Crazy Tune.
Thank you so much.
Locas palabras, melodia loca. No. And so in our first interview and first program from that interview, you described, you know, starting out in younger years as a 78 collector who didn't shy away from collecting foreign language recordings, and, you know, basically going from there into getting interested enough to delve into researching the performers on these recordings and their lives and cultural context, both abroad and the U.S. And there's still more I want to talk to you about. About that, about, you know, those Ottoman American Armenian diaspora recordings that we were talking about. But first, I want to just sort of give us and give the listener a broader taste of the truly worldwide scope of your catalog with Canary. I was thinking, just like, if I could get you off the top of your head to think of, you know, maybe three or four diverse tracks.
Well, sure. There's lots of stuff that I have been real interested in over the years. A lot of Asian music. I come from a background of sort of what you would call avant-garde electronic, kind of quasi-classical stuff. And in the process of being involved in that, all this stuff sort of coming out of the 60s and Fluxus and drone music and all that kind of minimalism and stuff. I was exposed to a lot of Indian music, for instance. When I was young, I grew up in a place, Wilmington, Delaware, which had the largest Hindu population in the United States during that time, during the 70s and 80s.
Oh, wow.
The DuPont chemical company brought over lots and lots of chemical engineers from India during my childhood, basically. So I was able to go actually hear Indian classical music live a lot of times as a teenager, and grew up around a lot of Indian kids and Indian grocery stores and stuff. I mean, I cannot name a raga by ear. You know, there's so much I don't know, but I just really loved the music for a long time. Yeah. And I know the people to ask for information when I hear something. I've been able to track down good sources of information.
Right. And so you heard this music as you were getting interested in drone, type musics.
Right. Well, specifically, when I was 19 years old, I wrote a very earnest letter to artists in New York City named Lamont Young and Marian Zazila. And they had been very involved in Indian classical vocal music since the late 1960s. But anyway, I went and lived with them, and they had shrines in their living spaces, which had photographs on them of Abdul Karim Khan and Abdul Wahid Khan, who were the foremost exponents in the early 20th century of the Kirana Gharana. So I saw these photos of these men with these giant turbans and these, sort of heavily lidded, very stoned looking faces. And I thought, who are these guys? Like, that's where the real stuff is, right? And you couldn't get that stuff. Couldn't get it, couldn't get it. And eventually, the advent of the internet, I get into my 19, into my 30s, and I get my hands on some of those records, some of the old 78s of Abdulkarim Khan in particular. Abdulwahid Khan never recorded. He only ever, there are recordings of him, of his radio broadcasts, but he never made studio recordings. A lot
Was that
of
All India
serious,
Radio?
yep, exactly, All India Radio. And it was a lot of, it was a thing in the early 20th century. Two problems, right? Number one, as with Western classical singers, very serious singers considered recording technology just toys. Like that wasn't the way to hear music. You couldn't really hear the heart, the soul of music through sound recording. You had to hear it live, right? So, it, in fact, that was the whole reason that Caruso was recorded, was to legitimize sound recording as an artistic medium. And because he recorded, they paid him way more than they would ever be able to recoup. But because he recorded, then other serious opera singers would also record. Something similar was true in India with the very serious singers, never mind the fact that, of course, serious music was very long form. You're looking at 15,
Like
20
opera is
minutes,
long
half an
form.
hour, an hour to get across a single performance. Can't be done on the side of a record. And more importantly, the main record company was HMV, His Master's Voice, which was British. During the 1920s and 30s, most serious artists in India had the political consciousness of what was going on with Gandhi and the fact that there needed to be to overthrow the colonial powers. So they
His
wouldn't record
master's
for
voice.
political reasons.
What
Yeah.
the
Yeah, right.
hell is that about anyway?
Oh, do you know
You
the
look that one
story?
up? Do you know that?
So the painting that was done of the dog Nipper, you could listening to his master's voice on the gramophone, and he's cocking his head and going like, "Oh, I recognize this. Do you know what Nipper is sitting on? Have
I
you
do
seen the whole
not.
painting? A coffin. The dog is listening to his dead master." That's what that picture is. That's why it's his master's voice. You can hear from beyond the grave. Maybe you know the story too, that this was one of Edison's original ideas when he invented sound recording, or invented the reproduction of sound, was he thought one of the things it was going to be useful for was recording the words of people on their deathbeds. And that that was going to be a thing
Certainly.
that, yeah, they'd be able to market it for that.
Oh.
Anyway, long story, but so a lot of the Indian musicians wouldn't record, the very high level people
Yeah, good
for
for them.
the British companies, but they would record for the Germans, who Odeon Records they would record for. So Abdulkarim Khan, for instance, did record for Odeon.
Yeah, all right. So hang on a minute, because now you have put out already, what, two volumes of Abdulkarim Khan with long liner notes. So, you
Yes.
got some nuts out of that. Abdulkarim Khan and Abdulwahid Khan were brothers, is that right?
cousins.
Cousins
Yes.
who worked together, but then had a falling out.
Well, it was very complicated. Okay, where to begin? Both were from their families were from a village called Kirana in the far north.
Ronnie, you already mentioned that name, right? Because
Say again.
you already mentioned that name because the musical style comes from that place.
From Kirana, right, exactly. So the school is the school of the location. Now, coming out of that location, musicians were court servants, basically. That was their job. They were help around the big courts of the Maharajas. And they would travel from one Maharaja to another and would be paid to be live-in resident artists. And this is what Abdulkarim Khan and Abdulwahid Khan's family did for generations, was go
Not
from
that
court to court.
different, maybe, from what in Indonesia, the gamelan sets were doing, right?
Right. Well, but the, a gamelan set the set of instruments lives in a particular chord.
Right. That's the difference. The
Right.
instruments
Yeah.
are the
And
are
but the musicians are again paid employees and
yeah.
sort of not particularly high level employees, frankly. You know, they're not
Right.
powerful people. In the case of India in the 19 late 19th, early 20th century, there was a power dynamic issue as well, which is that the court musicians tended to be Muslims and the people who were paying them tended to be Hindus. Abdul Karim Khan saw Indian music as a pan-Indian thing that included both
Right.
Hindu and Muslim traditions and was a hybridist. He wound up having this scandalous thing happen when he was working at one particular court, which is that he fell in love with a princess who he was teaching. It was part of his job was he had to teach the daughters of the royalty,
Right, but she was above his station.
vastly. And they ran away in the middle of the night. And on horseback with one servant and a sibling and started a new life and had a bunch of children. And it was complicated. They wound up getting divorced very acrimoniously, even though they were collaborators on a music school that he founded. Now, also because he could no longer work in the courts because he had been disgraced by having had the scandal, he began singing in public for money to whomever. So he's singing high-level court music for anybody who will, throw some money into the hat to come
Right.
see him play.
Right. So there's
Meanwhile,
an interesting way for, an interesting route for popular musical development that just happens to be happening
right.
in this early 20th century time.
Yes, you have a classical court musician who falls out of the nest down into the world of the rest of the people, of the folk, right? And he becomes immensely popular and immensely influential, partially because he has this music school and partially because he makes records that find their way to places where people would not have otherwise been able to hear, you know. Meanwhile, his cousin Abdulwahid Khan, who's this very self-indulgent, he's a big dope smoker. He's very into opium. Like he's a pleasure seeker, right? He really doesn't like Hindus and really keeps himself separate from them. So they have very different points of view politically, and they're very different personalities. But they're both connected to the process of the changing political world and the music school. So anyway, Abdul Karim Khan goes through this very acrimonious divorce. He cracks up. He winds up bringing his dog on stage to howl with him. At a certain point in his middle age, he becomes estranged from all of his children, several of whom go on to have very serious, important careers as musicians. Hirobai Barodikar was
Yes.
his daughter, who's an immensely important musician,
Yes,
wonderful
I know
singer.
that name. Her
She's Abdul Karim
voice
Khan's
is great.
daughter, but was trained by Abdul Wahid Khan, his cousin, because
Okay.
her dad was always on tour, and furthermore had these Muslim ideas about women not being having, careers. And the fact that Hirabai Barodikar's mother changed all the children's names from Muslim names to Hindu names after the divorce. So very complicated, difficult life that Abdul Karim Khan had, and it really comes through. He winds up recording a lot very late in life, 19 sort of 34 to 37. He records prolifically. Now, I know all of this stuff basically just because I knew a guy. His name was Suresh Chandavandkar, wonderful person. He used to have business cards he'd hand out that said he was the honorary secretary of the Society of Indian Record Collectors. It was a title he invented for himself.
All right.
He was a dedicated amasser of old 78 RPM discs since he was a teenager.
I have
He had
come
a
across what looked like it was at one point a monthly sort of newsletter
Exactly.
for Indian
That's
recordings.
Suresh.
That's the same. All right.
So when I got interested in Abdul Karim Khan, for instance, I got my hands on some discs. I wrote to him and said, "Oh, would you be interested in helping me maybe do some translating, stuff like this?" And he just buried me in information and research. Absolutely. He's like, "Here, take everything, read all of this." And I went for it. And the two of us
Right, take the whole
together,
monastery, while we're at
right, really. Now it turns out there had been a monograph written just about Abdul Karim Khan. By a guy in Australia named Michael Kinnear, brilliant discographer. Michael Kinnear published this book just about Abdul Karim Khan and then withdrew it from circulation. So there were only a handful of copies known to exist. Suresh had one, and he Xeroxed me the entire book and sent it to me spiral bound. So I had this resource that was just unbelievably thorough and detailed.
These people and you among them. I mean, this story makes clear it really is very parallel to medieval scribal work, what you've done. How else are these lineages of not that long ago, but that still matter in real places with real people and have a legacy of sound, their story is preserved thanks to these links.
Yeah, there really must be a community and it must be collaborative work. And it's very, very important that we're all rowing in the same direction, as the discographer Dick Spotswood once put it. Yeah, it's no one can do it by themselves. So we all make whatever contributions we can make. And as with, any scientific study, are continuously correcting. You get the best data you can get. And then when there's gaps, you hope somebody comes along and fills in those gaps later. And that we're all, in the end, producing a body of knowledge that the world can then use for whatever purposes.
So on that topic of data and gaps in the data, how are you able to determine how much any of these records sold, at the time? It sounds like you're saying a lot of this information all has to be rediscovered to be able to tell which records, which performers kind of broke through, among the Turkish and Armenian records, let's say.
Just in sales terms.
Well, if what you're saying about, what kind of documentation do we have? We Victor Records, two main record companies, early 20th century, Victor and Columbia. Victor kept all their files. So there's still information about recording dates, accompanists, all this kind of stuff for the Victor material. The Columbia stuff, they threw all their files away. So all of that has had to been reconstructed by researchers over decades and collectors. And as a collector myself, somebody who's been in a lot of Armenian households, there are three records that occur over and over and over again in these households. And they're Hayastan by Amarnak Shamaradian, Grunk by Zaba Panosian, and Egin Hevasi by Kemeny Minas. Basically, every Armenian or Turkish-speaking household in the U.S. had a copy of one of those records. There's another one in Turkish that occurs all over the place, must have sold kind of getting to near 100,000 copies, called Why I Came to America by a guy born in Turkey who was Greek named Achilles Poulos. Big hit record, recorded in 1926. I think I have eight copies of this record sitting on my shelves over here right now. I will literally send you one if you
Of
want
the
one.
78?
They're not worth anything. They're worth like 10 bucks. Still, nobody knows how great this record is. I've been, shouting into a bucket for a decade. Egin by Kemeny Minas. It's a masterpiece. It's a beautiful, beautiful record. And
So here you go. You managed to go back a century and still be ahead of your time.
it's possible to do when the thing you're interested in, nobody else cares about.
But you're doing it for humanity and for history. I'm talking with Ian Nagoski, who is the proprietor, the force behind Canary Records, a remarkable attempt to catch up with, recording history. We're talking largely so far about music you put on what seems like your first big Ottoman compilation, but this is already almost a decade ago that you completed this, right? So you have
Yeah, it
a
came out in 2011, right? Yeah.
there's more than a decade's worth since then, included in this extensive catalog, which I had the intelligence to join as a subscriber.
Thank you.
The work you've done since then.
A prolific output, like a couple of dozen records a year, and so diverse. Just for example, there's
Four volumes of Tarab vocals and instrumentals from the Middle East, actually. But those recordings were made in the Middle East, it seems like you're saying.
in 2024, you put those out.
I was very lucky to come into contact with people who had significant collections of recordings made very early, mostly during the 19 teens, recorded all in Cairo and Beirut, that were physically imported by immigrants to the US at an enormous expense at the time, and then taken good care of for, a century by the families, and then were willing to, share those discs with me, and I was able to make good transfers and, learn a fair amount about them. I love that stuff. And Arab music is really not paid attention to in America, in particular, the West generally. But I think if people understand it as a middle point between flamenco and Indian classical music, North Indian classical music, that there's a declamatory, monophonic thing going on with it that is ecstatic, that it's just really wonderful stuff. It takes some adjustment, if you're not familiar with the music, but making it available, I hope, will give people the chance to absorb it and sink in and, change their ears.
You need to be trained to listen well, especially to foreign stuff. This is what I was trying to ask, tips on how to listen. What have you learned from all that?
To listen to the stuff, again, I'm a melting pot of an American, and I am fully a dilettante. I cannot name one raga by ear. I cannot name one maqam by ear. And this is highly sophisticated art music with long traditions of people who are very well trained and know the music, in detail. Never mind the language barrier. So I don't have any of the poetry unless somebody translates it for me. But the one can hear a voice pretty well, if you just recognize that it's a human being, and that what a voice is a column of breath that runs in and out of a human being all day, every day of their life. And you think about what your voice can do and the voices of people you know, and then you consider, how do you arrive at a place where a voice can do such a thing? You immediately begin to get a sense of whether somebody is for real or not, whether they're invested, whether they're telling you something they believe is the truth. And that's what I'm always listening for, is this person invested? Are they telling you the truth, or are they just putting on an act? Now, all performers have to make a living. To some extent, everyone puts on an act, but there's a subtle difference thing. You can, and it doesn't have to be folk. It doesn't have to be down home. It can be a trained, serious performer, and you still get that sense of immediacy and beauty when somebody really has their guts in it. You know what I mean?
Oh, well, I'm inclined to agree, let's put it that way. You were saying that many or most Armenian homes in the US had three particular recordings. One of them we played on the last episode, Grung by Zabel Panossian. The other
Yes.
two were
Well, the other two are between, if an Armenian household had a gramophone, a record player, between, let's say, 1915, 1925, one almost invariably finds these three records: the Panossian record of Garung, Sold Like Hotcakes. A collaborator of hers named Armanag Shamaradian, who had arrived right at the onset of the First World War. He's an interesting person, not my favorite singer in the whole world, but a good story, in that he was a poor choir conductor and music student who had wound up studying in Georgia under Gomitas Vodarpid, the great patriarch of Armenian music at the end of the 19th,
Georgia
beginning
in
of
the
the 20th century.
Caucasus.
Georgia and the Caucasus, right, exactly. Gomita, he studied under a number of people there, but he was a serious music student studying choral music and vocal music. And Gomitas, who was a celibate priest, a ethnomusicologist, folklorist, and a composer who had studied in Germany, among other places, was d involved in a project of collecting Armenian folk music and publishing it in arrangements and passing it down to the generations as something similar to what Béla Bartók was doing around the same time, as a matter of fact. So Shamaradian, the student of his, who's a re young revolutionary who's attending meetings and going to protests, gets arrested twice. And the second time he's arrested, he's led out by a beneficent Turkish military guy, winds up going back home, living poor for a while, then gets out of there, makes it to Paris. In Paris, he gets some lessons and is lucky enough to goes to the Schola Cantorum. But anyway, he gets in the circle of the Parisian music world, the first decade of the 20th century, stars in Gounod's Faust at the Paris Grand Opera, and becomes a huge star. And from that is able to tour all over Europe, leading him back to Constantinople, Istanbul in 1912, where he makes a series of records together with Gomitas Vodarpid. Now, Gomitas gets arrested at the beginning of the genocide and survives, but suffers badly for the rest of his life with psychological problems, what we would call PTSD, I guess, or depression, and lives the rest of his life in psychiatric facilities in Paris. Meanwhile, the young man, Shamaradian, can't go back to Paris because of the First World War, goes instead to New York City with his wife and daughter. And there he meets up immediately with this young singer, Zabel Panossian. And the two of them are very concerned about death and suffering among their people back in the homeland for very good reason, and begin doing benefit concerts, sending money back home, using their talents to raise money, right? It's a big deal in the US, raising money for the starving Armenian. Give to the starving Armenian. When he arrives in the US, because he had been a big star in Paris, When he goes to Detroit or Syracuse, New York, for that matter, all the newspaper articles announce we have this like world-renowned great opera star coming to sing for us. And then at the very bottom of the article, it would say, oh, and there's also this girl from Boston, Zabel. Over the course of several years, the roles reverse. They're both doing benefit concerts together separately, but then when they perform together, it winds up being Zabel is the star, and then also we're getting Shah Moradian singing.
How
So
interesting.
it so happens.
Would that have had to do with the success of the Grung album? Just not an album, a
Maybe,
single.
maybe. And I think that she also improved as a singer during that period. She got to be quite good. Shah Moradian made a number of records, apparently funded by the same people who funded Zabel's records. The most popular of them by far is Highest End. That's the one you see all the time. Sold probably tens of thousands of copies. Highest End just means Armenia in Armenian, right?
Ah, so it's like an Armenian patriotic
Patriotic.
vow.
Yeah. And almost all of his repertoire is 19th century patriotic arranged, classically arranged folk and religious music. And it's a political program of giving Armenians access to a thread of Armenian culture which is unTurkified, which doesn't contain the traces of the oppressors, as it was seen, musical heritage, which is what most Armenians going to picnics would have been listening to and playing was folk songs in Turkish. The vast
Aha,
majority,
I
the
see.
vast majority were playing oud and kanun and playing music that, yes, Armenian, but yes, also Turkish, and certainly in the Turkish language,
Right.
right?
So it's like a political program to sort of reorient an Armenian culture, like which you
Yes.
could do. You're in a new world, right?
Yes. And this is part of the circle of intellectuals to which they belonged, was in, creating an Armenian identity, as there was the need for such a thing as a homeland. There were beginning to be projects of, by the end of the First World War, the idea of creating an Armenian nation became a primary goal, among Armenians all over the world. So they're contributing to that in their artistic way, that political goal, right? Okay.
Yeah.
So then Shamaradian, we really don't know what happens to him. He lives in the US into the middle late 20s, goes back to Paris with his wife and daughter. We know that he died in a psychiatric facility himself there. So there's two of the three that you always find. And then the third one is in Turkish, but it's a very Armenian subject. It's an old Armenian folk song called Aigen Hevasi, the melody of Aigen, which is a town out in the eastern part of Anatolia. It's an old, the original folk song was about emigration, as a matter of fact. It was about missing home and being missed by your family, your wife. But it was rewritten at the end of the 19th century after a catastrophe, after a massacre that occurred in Aigen as a result of a terrorist attack by revolutionaries, Armenian revolutionaries on the main bank of Constantinople, Istanbul. A group of young revolutionaries occupied the bank. One of them happened to have been from Aegean. So, in retaliation, the military goes to Aegean and, in one night, burns half of the homes and kills one third of the population. So, the song, sad song about Aegean, was rewritten in Turkish about that catastrophe. The version that was recorded in the United States in 1917 by a guy whose name on the record was Kemani Minas was a combination of both songs, the emigration song and the catastrophe song. So it spoke directly to the situation that Armenians in the aftermath of the genocide found themselves in, both the sense of catastrophe and everything having burned, and the sense of being far away from home and missing it, right? But I went around for years saying we will never know who Kemeny Minas is, because Kemeny is an honorific that just means violin player, master violinist, I guess. And Minas is like a really common name. A lot of people name Minas.
Okay.
So we're never going to know who's this good violinist Minas, right? I went around saying that for like a decade. And then one night, middle of the night, I get an email from my buddy Harut Arakelian out in LA, and he goes, "Dude, found Minas." And I was like, "What?" Yeah, he sends me a link to a Dropbox folder. The folder's full of documentation, references, translations of stuff from magazine articles and stuff. He and Harry Kazelian, another researcher who I worked with on the Zabel Panosian project, came up with all these various little references that seemed to match, and they figured it out. They figured out a whole timeline, and they got his name, which now I can't remember. But Harry wrote up an article with a biography, and we now know who Minas was, including the fact that he was not a big famous classical singer of any kind. He was not even a singer of these kind of laments, typically. This is the only record he made in this kind of style. He made a few gazelles, which are very beautiful, sad, slow songs, but most of what he recorded, vast majority, party records, picnic records, jams, stuff to get drunk to, stuff to dance to, right? He was a party guy. He was pretty young, as a matter of fact, and was having a good time as a bachelor, hanging out with dancers and gambling and drinking and stuff, right? He's a good time guy. But we knew that Minas disappears immediately after his 1917 sessions. There's just nothing else recorded, even though he had this big hit record with Egan. Turns out he died 6 months after having recorded because he had tuberculosis. And this powerhouse vocal performance, one of the great vocal performances I've ever heard in my life. I mean, I love this record. He had holes in his lungs, just like Jimmy Rogers 10, 15 years later. We have this incredible performer with this, holes in his lungs, making these big hit records that changed Armenian music. I mean, his repertoire on these records then becomes adopted by what becomes, what, Kef music. Are you familiar with that term?
No.
Kef, KEF. It's actually the Turkish word for stoned, but in
Right.
Armenian music in America, Kef just means good times, just
Right.
means relaxing, having fun, right? So this is this repertoire that becomes the basic party music for social events for Armenians in the US. And a lot of it really comes straight out of the Minas repertoire. However,
Right.
there's Egan. Egan's one of a kind. And I think it's just one of the best records America ever produced, I just love this guy.
Hey, strong words of introduction.
Man, it's a
Right,
rocker. I mean,
Ian Nagoski, proprietor
it's
of
a heavy,
Tenere Records.
heavy record, man.
Musician.
Like, if you like deep, strong feelings, if you like Dark as the Night, Cold as the Ground by Blind Willie Johnson, you will like Hagen by Kemeny Minas.
So there you go. There's some of the defining pieces of Armenian American heritage on recordings.
Now, we
Okay.
did briefly mention another record, which is very significant, which is another Columbia 12-inch disc from New York City, 1926. And it's a guy from a small city in Turkey, the Greek guy named Achilles Poulos. And it's a rewrite of an old folk song that was called Why I Came to Istanbul, about somebody who had migrated and regretted it. But he rewrote it as Why I Came to America and recorded it as a 12-inch disc for Columbia in Turkish. And it sold like an insane number of copies. We don't know how many, tens of thousands, certainly. I personally, again, have owned a dozen of them over the years. I think I have two or three right now. They're always beat up because they always came out at parties when you're drinking. And it's a song about, I wish I never came, I wish I never saw. It was a dumb idea to come here, right?
Neden geldim Amerika'ya? Neden geldim Amerika'ya? Tutuldum kavrim amare. Tutuldum kavrim amare. Şimdi bin kere pişmanım. Şimdi bin kere pişmanım. Fakat geçti ah ne çare. Fakat geçti ah ne çare.
Now, it so happens that just like Kemeny Minas, Achilles Poulos vanished after making his records. He recorded prolifically from, say, 1925 to 1929. 4 years, he records 150 songs. He's got a big repertoire. And then he just vanishes. And the story was for years that I heard was that he got ratted out to the immigration services for having recorded an anti-American song. People told the story like, oh, he got deported, right? There's a period of like anti-immigration and da da da, and you've got this guy and you do know what he's saying, you know, why I came to America, I never should have come. Turns out that's not true at all. Turns out he left New York, goes to Connecticut, goes to work for a coffee roaster, and lives there into the 1970s. I think he had arthritis, and I think he drank too much. He was a complicated character. All of the rumors and stories that I get about him include drinking to some extent or another. Yeah, I like
I hope he
Achilles.
changed his mind about regretting coming here.
Who knows? Who knows? So anyway, it's a big hit record and one that you run into in every Turkish-speaking household around the United States, which would have included largely Armenians, and to some extent Turkish-speaking Greeks, and to a very small extent, and I don't know really what these households would have contained, the Turkish-speaking households in Massachusetts, of which there were some hundreds around Peabody in particular. There were Turkish Muslims settled there for a period of 25 years or so. And then in the late 1920s, they basically all went home because America was so intolerant toward Muslims. There was just no reason, there was no reason to stay. Whereas Armenians had no home to go back to, except Armenia, which was very far away from where most of them came from. So they just left. And I don't know what their record collections were like in particular.
Oh, but I mean, the stories you've told, and I'm glad to hear more about these recordings because they each give a little angle of insight, I guess, on, I mean, let's just say crassly, what makes a recording popular, but underneath that, is what you can learn about how people and cultures work from that.
Yeah, this is the fun part, is that every good record has a story behind it and will tell you something about not just the life of the person who made it, their family, their feelings, but also who they were singing for, who their audience was and what their audience wanted from them, right?
I mean,
Musicians got to make a living. You know, you can't live if you don't have an audience. You know, so you got to, if you're going to sell records, you got to give them what they want.
all right. So, that being said by someone who has, produced what, 150 records by now? So you must be giving them what they want.
No, I'm not. Otherwise, I might be making a living.